Thanks, Ernesto. Okay, so today I want to talk to you about some work I've been doing jointly with Rob Speckens. And it has to do with the connections between these three things. So I'm presuming that there are probably some people in the audience who don't know what at least one or two of these things are. So I'm going to start out with a bit of background and history to motivate this before telling you what our main results are going to be. Okay, so what's pre and post selection about? Well, pre and post selection was introduced in a paper by Ahrenhold, Bergman, and Leibowitz in 1964. And what they consider is this type of experiment here. So you have three points in time, you make three measurements on a quantum system. The first one's called the pre-selection, and the last one's called the post-selection. And then you throw away all of the statistics from outcomes from, apart from one particular outcome of the pre-selection and one particular outcome of the post-selection. And you don't necessarily know what measurement has happened here. You know some measurement has happened there. And if somebody later on comes and tells you, I actually made this measurement, say a spin-up measurement of a spin or something, then you try to figure out what the probabilities are for that, based on what you know about both the pre-selection and the post-selection. So in these type of experiments, you can introduce a formalism for that, which is called the two-state vector formalism. And there was a review article of that by Ahrenhold and Weidman. And the essential idea is that, well, this pre-selection is just a preparation. So you can associate that with a state vector. And the post-selection you can also associate with the state vector. And these both go into your computation of the measurement probabilities. So why would anybody be interested in doing this? Well, there was a foundational motivation in this particular paper, which has to do with time symmetry of quantum measurements. So, well, when you're trying to think about interpretations of quantum mechanics, there are several choices you have to make. And one of those choices is whether to interpret the state vector as somehow corresponding to a state of reality, or whether it's just a device for computing probabilities somehow. So these guys wanted to interpret it as a state of reality. And from that perspective, the usual quantum formalism is rather puzzling, because you know you have these two different things, different types of evolution for a quantum state. The usual unitary evolution, which comes from the Schrodinger equation, and you also have the collapse of the wave function. So unless you are willing to come up with a particular physical mechanism for the collapse of the wave function, it appears to be a fundamentally time asymmetric concept, if the state vector is a state of reality, because you have wave functions collapsing, but you don't have them sort of uncollapsing. And so what they pointed out in this paper was essentially that if you use this formalism, then it does look time symmetric, because if you run this whole thing back in time, then all that happens is that the post-selection and the pre-selection vector exchange their roles. So that was their motivation for introducing that. Well, I mean, you can take this interpretational idea slightly further if you wish to. So here's what Ahrenhold had to say about it in this review article. So he says, even at present, before the future measurement, the backward evolving quantum state exists. It exists in the same way as the quantum state evolving from the past exists. An element of arbitrariness, why this particular outcome and not some other, might discourage. But the alternative, the collapse of the quantum wave, is clearly worse than that. Okay. So what he's saying here is that he wants to really treat both of these state vectors on an equal footing, and you need both of them to describe the complete state of reality. So you can go even further than this as well. And you could adopt what's called the counterfactual interpretation of this ABL probability rule, the probability rule for these experiments. And that's, well, one person who stated it was Morhov in 2000. It's been described in a number of other papers by other authors as well. but here it's stated particularly clearly. It says ABL probabilities are based on a complete set of facts and are therefore objective only if none of the measurements to the possible results of which they are assigned is actually performed. That is, only if between the preparation or pre-selection and the retroperation or post-selection, no measurement is performed. So what does he mean by that? Well, when you compute probabilities in the way that ABL prescribed, you assume that you have some pre-selection event, some post-selection event, and you assume that some measurement actually, the measurement you're computing the probabilities for actually occurred. So what he's saying here is that the same probabilities that you compute in this situation should be applied to being somehow objective properties in this situation, where there's no actual measurement happening in the middle. So I mean, there are various obvious difficulties with this, such as what do you mean by an objective set of properties, an objective set of probabilities for something that doesn't happen. But assuming that you can be happy with those, that kind of interpretation, there are still some other difficulties with it. So it has several difficulties. So essentially we'll see later on that there are these things called logical pre- and post-selection paradoxes, that if you adopt the counterfactual interpretation would imply that reality is contextual, i.e. That the property that you're measuring you can't assign a unique value to the property that you're measuring independently of how you choose to measure that property. Now, you may not be too worried about this because you know from the Bell Clock-Specker theorem that quantum mechanics is contextual anyway. But what is slightly worrying about it, in fact very worrying about it, is that if you were to make a similar interpretation of classical probability, that would also imply that reality is contextual, and we'll see that later. And so, you know, you don't really want to think of classical probability as being contextual in any sense. And the reason why this result occurs is because the counterfactual interpretation doesn't take into account the fact that measurements might actually disturb the state of the system. And so in that case, this situation is sort of not at all comparable to this situation. But we'll see in more detail what I mean by that later. So there doesn't really seem to be any compelling reason to treat the ABL probabilities in this counterfactual way. But this has been debated quite a lot in the literature, and this article contains quite a good summary of the whole debate here. So our main results are going to be that these pre- and post-selection paradoxes can actually be explained in non-contextual hidden variable theories, provided measurements disturb the values of hidden variables. And I'll come up with a specific toy example which illustrates that. And the surprising thing is that every one of these logical PPS paradoxes in quantum mechanics is actually closely related to a proof of contextuality, which is constructed from the same set of measurements. Now, at first sight, these two things might seem to contradict each other. I'll explain why they don't, but it does sort of suggest that there's something further to be said about this. Okay, so maybe not everybody sitting in this room is interested in esoteric interpretations of quantum mechanics. So I'd like to say why we should care about pre- and post-selected systems if you don't care about this counterfactual interpretation. Well, the most straightforward reason is that despite the controversy over the counterfactual interpretation, this formalism does agree with quantum mechanics. It gives the correct quantum mechanical predictions for actual measurements that are performed on such systems. So therefore, you know, you can go away and do experiments on these things, and they correspond to real effects that you can find in the laboratory if you wish to. This formalism, the two-state vector formalism, has yielded results which are of interest to quantum information theorists in particular. You may have heard about the mean-kings problem, which has interested a lot of people, partly because it's related to things like mutually unbiased spaces and stuff like that, which we've heard about in some earlier talks in this series. There are also some cryptography protocols which are directly based on this formalism. by these authors. It has to be said that they're nowhere near as nice as the standard ones, and you know there aren't any security proofs or anything, and they make well. So, but it's sort of interesting that you can construct something from this idea. Another reason to be interested from a theoretical point of view is that the formalism has been extended much beyond the point at which I'm going to describe it in this talk. And you can describe much more general types of pre and post selection, in particular correlated pre and post selections. So in the diagram I had here, I imagine that whether or not you throw out the outcome of the pre-selection measurement is completely independent of whether or not you throw out the outcome of the post-selection measurement. But you can imagine, you know, some situation where, for example, if outcome one occurs here, then you throw away outcome one here. And if outcome two occurs here, then you don't, for instance. So they can be correlated. And this is sort of the type of situation which you have in the standard quantum cryptography protocols, such as the BB84, B92, and those kind of things. So it might be interesting to look at these within the formalism. Also, there's an analog of entanglement in this more general formalism. It's the kind of entanglement between different points in time. And this sort of might be regarded as a resource in quantum information in the same way as regular entanglement is, and it might be interesting to see how that's used in different protocols or whether it can be thought of as a resource in the same way. So from my point of view, and this is really the reason why I got interested in this stuff, from my point of view it seems very likely that many of these pre and post selection effects could be exploited in quantum information. But to find out if this is the case, we really need to sort of re-examine the foundational questions a bit. So in particular, we're going to want to know if these effects are somehow genuinely quantum or whether they have classical analogs. If they can be done classically, how efficiently? Are there things that you can do more efficiently using pre and post selection effects? So really, I want to re-examine the foundational questions with this sort of motivation in mind. Okay. Are there any questions so far? So here's an outline of the rest of the talk. First of all, I'm going to describe an operational notation for measurements, because I'm going to want to compare the same scenarios in different theories, in particular quantum theory and hidden variable theories. So it's important to sort of have a notation that's independent of which theory I'm talking about. Then I'm going to describe the pre and post selection scenario in quantum theory. And eventually I'll get to the simplest example of what I've been calling a logical PPS paradox, which is the so-called three-box paradox. Then I'm going to look at what pre and post selection is like in hidden variable theories. I'm going to first of all give an analog, a very close analog of the three-box paradox, which you might call the partition box paradox. But as we'll see, it's not really a paradox. It's more of a kind of explanation for how these kind of effects might arise in such a theory. I'll look a bit more generally at hidden variables and what pre and post selection looks like in them, define non-contextuality, and look a bit at how these three things are related. But the main point of doing this is then I'll be able to define in more generality what a logical pre and post selection paradox is. And then I'll be able to state the kind of surprising theorem, which actually shows that despite all this stuff, there is actually a connection between contextuality and these paradoxes. And I'll illustrate that with an example. Probably there'll only be time to go through one of them. Okay, so I'm going to want an operational notation for measurements. So I'm going to denote measurements by letters like M and N and things like that. And for me, a measurement is just some physical process, whatever, that gives you a random variable as a result. And so I'll denote that random variable by X with the letter corresponding to the measurement. And I'm generally going to assume that measurements have a finite number of outcomes. That's just for simplicity. So whenever you see a subscript pre and post on something, it means it refers to the pre or post selection. And in particular, I'm going to have a notation a pre and a post, which represents that the pre or post selection was successful. So here's how these things fit into the general scheme I was talking about. And so the goal in pre and post selected systems is basically to compute this probability. So the probability of getting different outcomes given that the pre-selection was successful and the post-selection was successful, and given that you actually performed this measurement here in the middle. Okay. So I just want to quickly review, mainly for the purposes of notation, the formalism of measurements in quantum theory. So our states are going to be generally density operators, and I'm going to assume that they're on a finite dimensional Hilbert space for this talk. And I'm only going to consider measurements, I'm only going to consider sharp quantum measurements. Okay, so those are measurements which correspond to projective valued measures. So any kind of measurement has two parts. It has a statistical aspect, which tells you how to compute the probabilities of the different outcomes given a state. And in quantum mechanics, that's given by a set of projectors which sum to the identity, and the probability is given by the Born rule here. But they also have a transformation aspect which tells you how the state updates. And in general, the most general set of transformations that can be associated with a given PVM is a set of completely positive maps which satisfy this condition. The dual of the map acting on the identity gives you the projector, where the dual is defined for arbitrary operators A and B by this relation here. Okay, so on obtaining a particular outcome, the state updates by applying the completely positive map, corresponding completely positive map, and then normalizing the state. And one of the most important examples of that is the Luders rule. So this is the projection postulate, or the standard sort of collapse of the wave function state update rule, and that's given by just applying the projector on either side. And unless I say otherwise, all of the measurements I'm talking about are going to be Luders rule type measurements. Okay, so now we're interested in quantum mechanics in computing this probability here in this setup. So I'm going to make a few restrictions in order to do that. So let's see. So first of all, I'm going to assume that prior to the pre-selection, your density matrix is the identity. It's not always strictly necessary to do that, but it just simplifies things. I'm going to assume the pre-selection measurements updates according to Luders' rule. And then the pre and post-selections, they correspond to performing some PVM and throwing away the statistics that correspond to some outcomes and only keeping the statistics that correspond to one particular outcome. And those outcomes are going to be associated with projectors pi pre and pi post. And the measurement in the middle is more general. It corresponds to a PVM and a set of completely positive maps. So we're interested in computing this probability, but we can't apply the quantum formalism directly to this, because that only tells us how to compute probabilities for things that are related in the correct sort of sequence in time. Whereas here I want to compute something in the middle based on something that happened earlier and something that happened later. So in order to get the things that appear here in the right order, I just apply Bayes' rule, which is given here in this case. And then all of these things here, all of these probabilities, I can compute from the quantum measurement formalism. And so if you plug in all those things, then you end up with this rule down here. Okay. So that's the general rule. We're going to be interested in particular in some special cases of that. So when the intermediate measurement obeys Luders' rule as well, then you can replace those completely positive maps just by projectors, and you get this rule here. And in particular, when the pre and post selection projectors are rank one, that just corresponds to your pre-selection being checking if the system is in a given state, and similarly for the post-selection. then this thing reduces to this rule down here. And this is what's normally called the ABL rule in the literature. Yes? Oh, well, because the, so it's, well, yeah, so the Luders rule puts the projector on either side. So the preparation in this case corresponds to preparing a density operator which is proportional to pi pre. So your density operator starts out as the identity. If you get this outcome, you get a density operator proportional to pi pre. And then when you update, you get something proportional to this. OK. Yeah, it's slightly more general because this rule allows doesn't specify a particular update rule for the middle measurement. Okay.
It's still on the pre and post selection measurements you're assuming.
The pre-selection measurement you're assuming Luders rule. All the measurements are projective measurements. It's just the state update rule might not be. What, for in this case, for the middle measurement? I don't think necessarily, no.
Yeah, it's assuming that the Luders update was equivalent to assuming that the first operator was a projective.
Well, no, because that's only the case if your update only has one Krauss operator. So you could have a case where you sort of do a degenerate measurement by doing the more complete measurement and then forgetting the outcome, and then your Krauss operators will still be projectors, but yeah. Okay. Yes.
If people write down part of the slices in the context of consistent.
Yes.
But there you would have many intermediate projectors.
Yeah.
For reason that it's limited to just one here?
No, most of the results have been just for these kind of systems, but there are papers where they generalize it to many projectors, and it does have some connection with the consistent historicist formalism. It's not exactly the same because here, I mean, all of this is basically just, all these formulas are basically just operational formulas, and there's no requirement to restrict things to consistent sets, for instance, consistent sets of historicists. So this is, so in a way, it's a closely related formalism. But it's not exactly the same. Okay, so here's an example of the sort of strange predictions that you get from this rule. This is called the three box paradox, and it was first published in by Aronhoff, D'Amato, and Albert in the 1980s. So there are three boxes hanging somewhere over the River Thames in London. And for his next feat of magic, David Blaine is going to try and convince us that he can be in two of the boxes at the same time. So he somehow knows how to put himself in a superposition of being in the various three boxes. So you denote the state where he's in box one by one. Similarly for these two boxes. So your pre-selection here corresponds to preparing the equal superposition of all three, of being in all three boxes. And your post-selection corresponds to checking whether you're in this state. And the only difference between these two states is the sign in front of the three as a different phase there. And the two intermediate measurements that you do are either to the first measurement M, which I'm calling M, is just to check whether he's in box one. So that corresponds to these two projectors. And the second measurement is to check whether he's in box two. And so that corresponds to these two projectors. And if you plug these things into the ABL rule, you find that in this measurement, the probability of finding him in box one is equal to one. And in this measurement, the probability of finding him in box two is equal to one. And well, the mathematical reason for that is that in this case, in both these cases, at the bottom of the ABL rule, you have just two terms corresponding to the two outcomes. The first term is the same as the top term, and the second term is turns out to be zero, so that the overall the probability is one. And that those terms turn out to be zero, essentially because you have these opposite signs here. So you pick up here, you pick up the 2 and 3 term from here, and the 2 and minus 3 term from here, and those cancel. And similarly with the 1 and 3 terms down there. So if you were to take the counterfactual interpretation I described earlier, you would have to say something like he's in both boxes at the same time. Or at least you'd have to say which box he's in depends on what you choose to measure. And that seems similar to contextuality. It's the type of conclusion that you might have in the proof of the Bell-Koppensperger theorem. So this was sort of presented in the original paper as some kind of general, some kind of new quantum effect. So now I want to ask, is this really quantum mechanical, or can we find a simple classical model for this? And so I'm going to present a simple toy model which has exactly the same feature. Okay, you find that something has to be in one of two different places depending on how you choose to measure it. So this I'm going to call the partitioned box paradox. So the basic idea is I have an opaque box. Here we're looking down on it from the top. Okay, so this isn't really divided into four sections, but I just sort of label the top, label the back half, the front half, the left half, and the right half. And there are just two things I can do to this opaque box. One is I can divide it into front and back halves, or I can divide it into left and right halves. So you might imagine that you have some kind of double partition which you can either stick going down this way or going that way and then separate the two boxes. And so that gives you two opaque boxes. So there's the only two ways you can separate the box. Now, because the box is okay, so the other thing I should say is that somewhere in this box there's a ball, and our goal is, by making various measurements, to figure out something about where that ball actually is. So because the box is opaque, I can't simply look to see where the ball is. But there are four possible measurements I can make, which I'll call left verification, right verification, front verification, and back verification. So let me describe what left verification is like. To do left verification, I divide the box in this way into left and right halves. And then I pick up the left half of the box and give it a vigorous shake and see if I can hear the ball, that the ball is inside there. So if I do hear the ball, then I know it's on the left, but the act of shaking it causes the front back position to become completely randomized. I no longer know whether it's in the front or the back. On the other hand, if I do left verification and I don't hear the ball, then I know it's on the right and it stays where it is. Okay, and there's no disturbance. So here's what happens. If the ball is in all these four possible positions, if it's anywhere on the left, then all I know at the end is that it's in one of these two boxes. But if it's on the right, I know it's on the right, and I know it hasn't changed its position. Okay. So how does the analog of the three-box paradox work in this model? Well, so my pre-selection is to just do a successful front verification. So I check whether the ball's in the front, and I only keep the cases where it actually turns out to be in the front. The post-selection is a back verification. And then I have one of two measurements I can do in the middle, and that's either a left verification or a right verification. And I claim that if you do a left verification, it's definitely on the left, and if you do a right verification, it's definitely on the right. So it's fairly easy to see why that's the case. In the left verification case, I know from my pre-selection that the ball starts off in one of these two boxes. If I do a left verification and find it on the left, then I know its front-back position gets randomized, so it must have come from here, and its position gets randomized in the front and back. So then, if I do a post-selection, I know there are some cases where the ball ends up here, and my post-selection will be successful. On the other hand, if I do a left verification and find it's not on the left, it's on the right, then the ball must have been here, and it doesn't get disturbed because I didn't shake the right-hand side of the box. And so there's no way the ball can possibly end up in the back at the end of the post-selection. So given that this happened and this happened, I know for sure that, this must have happened. It must have been on the left. So similarly, with the right verification, exactly the same argument will tell you that it has to be found on the right. So if you wanted to make a sort of counterfactual interpretation of this case in the same way as is done in the quantum case, then you would somehow want to say, well, this corresponds to a real state of reality, and this corresponds to a real state of reality, and those probabilities are somehow objective, and so you'd be forced to conclude that the ball is both on the left and the right at the same time. But clearly this is a rather bizarre interpretation of this experiment. The correct interpretation is to just say, well, if I do different measurements, they disturb the ball in different ways. Okay, that's a much more straightforward explanation. Right, so now I want to generalize this a little bit and talk about the formalism of a general hidden variable theory and how this is related to other features of quantum mechanics, hidden variable theories of quantum mechanics. So a hidden variable theory in general is an attempt to describe quantum theory by saying that there really exist some states of reality. And we'll call these the set of ontic states. Okay. So in general, a quantum mechanical state will, might not, they won't be necessarily be a one-to-one correspondence between quantum mechanical states and these ontic states. That's why they're called hidden variables. But generally speaking, we'll say that a quantum state corresponds to just a some probability distribution over these. And it won't necessarily correspond to all probability distributions. So there may be some probability distribution like this one, which corresponds to a state. But for instance, I may have like the delta distributions where I know exactly what the hidden state is. They might not correspond to any quantum state at all. So an assumption that's usually made in the proofs of the Kolkin-Speicher theorem is called outcome determinism for sharp measurements. So this means that if you make a projective valued measurement, then the ontic state uniquely determines the outcome you're going to get. Now, it's not essential to have such an assumption in a hidden variable theory. You may want to subscribe to a theory where there's some kind of intrinsic randomness in nature, and then this wouldn't necessarily be true. But this is the assumption that's made, and there are various ways of justifying it. So, because we have outcome determinism, each measurement just partitions the set of ontic states into subsets which correspond to the different outcomes. Okay, so we can describe those subsets by indicator functions, which tell you whether or not the ontic state lambda will give you the outcome J of measurement M or not. Okay, because these things provide a partition of the ontic state space, they have to sum to the identity. And the probability in any distribution of getting the outcome is then given by this formula here. Okay. So generally speaking, there's also a transformation aspect associated with the measurement, how the state updates after you make the measurement. And we'll allow here for the fact that there might be some disturbance, okay? And measurements may somehow intrinsically disturb the state of the system. We'll also allow that disturbance to be probabilistic. It was in the model I described just before. So generally speaking, they'll correspond to a stochastic transformation, which where this matrix here is just the probability of a transition from an ontic state omega to an ontic state lambda, given that measurement M gave you outcome J. So we can then define a transition matrix which by just multiplying this with the characteristic function. And this plays the same role in the hidden variable theory as the completely positive maps did in the quantum formalism. I'll find that somewhere. So this formula here in particular is analogous to this formula in quantum theory. Yes?
Why do you allow genuine randomness in this transformation?
Well, it may not really be genuine randomness. It may be deterministic, but we just don't know what's happening, like in the example where you shake, where you're shaking the box. Yeah, it depends. But the unnamed parameter in that case is supposed to be land at the ontic state, and you have the random. Yeah, it could be, but that in my formalism that wouldn't be an outcome deterministic theory. And you wouldn't be able to prove the Bell-Cock and Speckle theorem for that kind of theory. I mean, that in a way that will be regarded as a kind of contextuality. If the outcome that you get depends on some unnamed parameter of your measuring apparatus, then clearly how you're measuring that quantity. What value you get for that quantity depends on how you're measuring it, because it depends on some parameter of the apparatus that's above and beyond sort of the projection. Sure, but I mean, I'm not saying that it's necessarily the most justified assumption in the world, but you have to make this outcome determinism assumption in order to prove. To generate the Cock and Speckle proofs. That's the assumption that's made. Yeah. All right, so given these transition matrices, we can see how the probability distribution is updated. And it's this. This just combines ordinary Bayesian updating with the disturbance caused by the measurement. Okay. So now we can describe pre and post selection in exactly the same sort of way as we did in the quantum formalism. Your pre-selection just prepares some probability distribution. Your post-selection corresponds to a particular outcome of a measurement, so that corresponds to a particular indicator function. The intermediate measurement is described by, you know, generally by a set of indicator functions and these transition matrices. Actually, it's enough to just specify the transition matrices. And then you do exactly the same thing as you do in the quantum case. You apply Bayes' theorem to and then you compute all those probabilities and you end up with this. Okay. Now the important thing to note here is that, well, I haven't said anything about contextuality yet, but you're computing the probability for a particular outcome, say J, but this probability here depends on actually on all of the transition matrices via the denominator here in exactly the same way as the ABL rule depends, well, in a very similar way to how the ABL rule depends on all of the projectors in the measurement. So this is sort of, roughly speaking, this is why you can generate these effects just using disturbance rather than needing contextuality. But let me explain in a bit more detail. So now I'll introduce the assumption of non-contextuality. Okay, so non-contextuality says essentially, that if there is an outcome of some measurement M and another outcome of another measurement that give you the same probability for all possible preparations you can make, then they should be represented by the same indicator function in your theory. And in a way, this is sort of an assumption of simplicity. It kind of says that if two things are completely equivalent, if two things in the quantum formalism are completely equivalent as far as quantum mechanics is concerned, as far as the probabilities are concerned, then we expect them to be represented in the same way in the hidden variable theory. So that's what non-contextuality means. So this equivalence in terms of quantum mechanics means that both the outcomes, if two outcomes are associated with the same projector, then they're associated with the same indicator function, because two different projectors will generally have different well, you can always find some states for which they have different different probabilities. So the fact that these indicator functions only depend on the projector means that in such a hidden variable theory, projectors are associated to essentially unique properties of the system. They just correspond to some subset of the ontic states. And so you can start talking about assigning probabilities to projectors. Okay, so for if you have a distribution, you can assign a probability to a projector via this formula. And the important thing here is that the distribution that comes in here doesn't necessarily need to be one that corresponds to a quantum state. It could be, for instance, the delta distribution. Okay, so you can derive from this and the fact that you want your theory to reproduce quantum measurements, you can derive some constraints on what these probabilities have to satisfy. So these are the basic ones. This basically just says that it has to be a probability. You know that if you have a projector P, there's a measurement which corresponds to the identity minus P and P. And obviously, the probability of those two outcomes have to sum to 1. There's a measurement which corresponds to, which only has one outcome, which just corresponds to the identity operator. So you must always get that outcome. And the probability of the null projector onto the null subspace is 0, because that corresponds to doing no measurement and doesn't have any outcomes. So these ones are slightly more involved to prove. But if you have two commuting projectors, then the probability of their product must satisfy these relations, and this must satisfy these relations. And for commuting projectors, this sort of has the this has the interpretation of essentially being meaning P and Q, and this has the interpretation of meaning sort of P and Q. That's in the case P or Q, sorry. And then these constraints follow for commuting projectors. So you may be more familiar with a different way of expressing this, so in particular we assumed outcome determinism. So if the distribution here is a delta distribution, that means that these probabilities are associated with a particular ontic state and not a distribution. And we know that the probabilities for ontic states, because of outcome determinism, are 0 and 1. So they have to satisfy these constraints, and also they must be 0 and 1 in that case. And that allows you to derive the usual sort of Koch and Specker assumptions, which say that if you have an orthogonal set of projectors, then one and only one of those must be assigned value 1, and the others must be assigned the value 0. And also, it means that the projectors must take the same value whichever orthogonal set you consider them in. So that's you can derive from those conditions. Okay, so these are the constraints on the probabilities assigned to projectors in a hidden variable theory defined by this formula. They're not constraints necessarily on probabilities assigned in a pre and post selection experiment. But if we choose to, we could also try to apply these constraints to the probabilities that come out of pre and post selection, right? we could say, well, maybe those have to satisfy these constraints as well. So we're going to sort of generalize the definition. We're going to sort of consider a general class of things, which include the three-box paradox as a special case. And we're going to say that we have a logical pre- and post-selection paradox whenever the ABL rule assigns probability 0 and 1 to the outcomes of some measurements, such that if you chose to associate the same probabilities with the projectors corresponding to those outcomes in a hidden variable theory, you would violate the algebraic conditions. So is that definition clear? Hearing no objections, I'll continue. Okay, so that's the general definition. And actually, you can construct many such. I only gave you one example, which is the three-box paradox. But you actually can construct many, many such things. Well, because it violates the algebraic conditions, you assign probability 1 to being in box 1 that corresponds to one projector. And then there's an orthogonal projector, box 2, which in another measurement is assigned probability 1. And that violates the Kolkin-Speckle conditions because you have a set of three orthogonal projectors, two of which are assigned the value 1 by those probabilities. Yeah, so in some sense they're more fundamental because these conditions would apply even in the case where they actually apply to distributions rather than particular ontic states. So those ones and zero conditions only apply to ontic states. So in a way these are more general. Technically speaking, you just have to have the conditions. You just have to take into account the fact that commuting projectors, sets of commuting projectors and their products and so forth, can be thought of as sort of elements of a Boolean algebra, and you just have to find some way of generating all the constraints that are imposed by that. And this is one way of doing it. You can consider other formulations if you want. Okay, so I'm not going to go into this because of time considerations. I'm not going to go to this in any detail, but you can sort of derive some constraints in a non-contextual model on what the disturbances have to be like. But I'm not going to dwell on that. Now that I've got to that definition, I can tell you what the theorem is. So the example I showed you earlier should lead you to suspect that these paradoxes have nothing at all to do with contextuality and they're just to do with measurement disturbance. But we proved the following theorem, which says whenever a set of projectors give ABL probabilities that give rise to such a logical pre- and post-selection paradox, and the pre- and post-selection projectors are not orthogonal to one another, then you can use some suitable fine grainings of these projectors together with the pre- and post-selection projectors to show, well, this just means to show that a non-contextual, measurement non-contextual model is impossible. Now, the subtlety here is that this doesn't say that the logical pre- and post-selection paradox is itself a proof of contextuality. It just says that the same mathematical objects that appear in one appear in the other. Okay, their interpretation is rather different. So I'm just going to give one example because of the time, and this is the one that's based on the three-box paradox. So the three-box paradox gives rise to a proof of contextuality, which was found by Clifton, and it was found by him completely independently of any considerations to do with pre- and post-selection. So these two things are independent, and we've shown that they're actually connected. Okay, so how does it work? Well, if you remember the three-box paradox, your pre-selection corresponded to an equal superposition of all three, of being in all three boxes, and the paste selection corresponded to this this superposition. Now, how does the proof of contextuality work? Well, first of all, I should say what this diagram represents. So the points in this diagram just represent different vectors in Hilbert space. And if they're connected by a straight line, it means they're orthogonal. So these three are all orthogonal to one another. These two are orthogonal to another. These three, and those are orthogonal, and those are orthogonal, etc. Right. So how does this proof work? Well, this pre-selection vector here, in a hidden variable theory, it corresponds to some distribution over the ontic states. And you know that if you prepare that state and then check to see whether the system is in that state, make a measurement that checks that has this as an outcome, then you always get the result which tells you you're in this state. If you start in this state, you're still in that state. So that means that all of the ontic states that are in the support of the distribution represented that represents this state must assign a value 1 to this state vector here. So I'm coloring it white to say that I know that there are some states which assign it a value 1, which we have probability 1. So now we look at the post-selection vector, and the thing to note about that is that it's not orthogonal to the pre-selection vector. So if I were to prepare this state and then do a measurement of this state, then I know that sometimes I get this outcome. And because of outcome determinism, it means that there must be some ontic states which are in the support of this distribution, which also give value 1 to this state. Okay. So I know that there must be some ontic states which assign this thing probability 1 and that thing probability 1. Right, so now because of these orthogonality relations, I have to assign this one probability 0, this one probability 0, and the same for these two. But then because these here form a complete orthogonal triple, one of them must be assigned the value 1. So it must be that one. And similarly here. But then you have a contradiction because these two are orthogonal and you should only have one of them. Okay, so the way this corresponds to the three box paradox is that these states correspond to, this state corresponds to one of the outcomes of the first measurement, checking to see whether you're in the first box. And if you take the span of these two vectors, then that subspace is a subspace where he's not in box 1. And similarly here, this is the box 2 subspace, and this is the not in box 2 subspace. And so what we showed in our theorem is that whenever you have one of those pre and post selection paradoxes, then you can always construct a contextuality proof of this sort. You always take the things that are assigned probability 0 by the ABL rule, and you can fine grain them in a certain way such that you can generate a paradox like this. Okay, so I think I will finish there. So to conclude, so we showed essentially that the existence of these logical pre and post selection paradoxes doesn't imply the contextuality of a theory. We have a simple model which has such an effect in it, which isn't contextual. But surprisingly, that every logical pre and post selection paradox is related to a proof of contextuality by the theorem I just described. So there seems to be a discrepancy between these two results. And what's the possible reason for this? Well, I think the reason is that hidden variable theories have to satisfy additional constraints in order to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. Okay, it's not enough for them to just reproduce these logical pre and post selection paradoxes. They have to have all of the other features of quantum mechanics we know about. So, you know, non-commutativity, some analog of the uncertainty principle, things like this. So we have a conjecture that if a theory has logical pre and post selection paradoxes in it, and there's a suitable analog of the uncertainty principle, we have to sort of define what that is. But if you have those two things, then we think that it might imply that the theory is contextual. And there's some justification for that. First of all, if you consider the model we looked at earlier, it is possible in this model. So if you had an analog of the uncertainty principle, you'd sort of imagine that, for example, if you knew whether it was in the front or the back, then you had no information about whether it was on the left or the right or something like that. That would be an analog of the uncertainty principle. But it is possible in this model to know exactly where the ball is. If you happen to do, say, a left verification and find that the ball is on the right, and you do a back verification and find that it's in the front, and neither of those things causes any disturbance, so you would know with certainty that the ball was in the front and on the right. So there's no kind of uncertainty principle there. We also had a look to see whether there were any of these kind of effects in the toy theory that Rob proposed, which probably quite a few of you have heard about. That theory is non-contextual, and it doesn't seem to have any logical pre and post selection paradoxes. But it also has an analog of the uncertainty principle of the sort that I was talking about. So that's not a proof, of course, but it's some evidence that this might be true. Okay, so other open questions are, well, are there any actual applications of these things in quantum information theory? It would be nice if there were some direct ones. And another question is whether any of this is useful in the axiomatics of quantum theory. So you might have, maybe these constraints sort of tell you something about the space of possible theories and what's special about quantum mechanics in particular. Okay, so that's it, thanks. That's it.
Another feature it has is that it's at the operation that it's the time asymmetric. You lose that time asymmetry if you have a quantum function loop. Because that certainty that the fact that you know what result you'll get in two different measurements is true in one direction but not in the other. So it seems like there's a loss of time for the trigger.
I like to think about these things sort of in terms of so if you're associating the probability distributions with your knowledge about the system, if somebody tells you that at the beginning you're in the front and at the end you're in the back, say, or they tell you in the beginning you're in the back and at the end you're in the front, then you get exactly the same result. It doesn't matter which direction you're playing in.
Shaking is working in a is it an operational point of view?
Well, I mean, I think it's the same because if you let's see. So if you knew, you could run the explanation in exactly the reverse direction that I did. So if you start off, if you know that at the end it was in the back, and then you know that it was that, and then you know that you did a left verification beforehand, right? So then you know that before this measurement, if the left verification found it on the left, it must have come from one of these two boxes. So you can sort of think of this as the disturbance in the opposite direction, so to say. You can infer from here that you must have come from there. And then if you didn't find it on the left, then you would infer that it must, if the place selection was successful, it must have been in this box, right? In this part of the box. And then you'd make the same inference, okay, there's no overlap with the front in this case, but there is in the other case. Yes.
Is that exactly the same as the quantum circuits in Monte Carlo, or is there some difference?
Okay, so I don't know what I did with that now. Must be somewhere here. Okay, so this, oh, here it is. Okay, so this diagram is actually it's actually just a part of the full diagram that you get in the original Kolpe-Specker proof. It consists of lots of these things sort of connected together. But the reason why in this case we only need this is that we're considering this is a different type of contextuality proof. So in the standard Kolpe-Specker type proof, you actually show there's no assignment at all of there's no assignment that you can make at all of ones and zeros or black and white to these things that respects the orthogonality relations. Here there is some assignment, like for instance if you chose one of these not to be true, then you could make such an assignment. But you're using the fact that you know something about quantum statistics to say that there must be some states which have these two. So it's a different type of proof, and it allows you to get sort of a much simpler proof. So generally speaking, what our theorem does is it shows that for these logical paradoxes, there's a proof of this sort. But it is sort of interesting that in some cases you can build a more general proof. So I was going to tell you about another example, which I won't go into in detail. But there's another example which gives you a proof that's like this, with two pre and post selection vectors. But in this case, in the case of this proof, what actually happens is that you have a logical pre and post selection paradox. So you can change these states into any of a complete set of orthonormal states here, and a complete set of orthonormal states here, and still have the paradox for the same set of observables. And that enables you to construct one of the sort of original Kolpe-Specker type proofs. It's actually the one by Mermin and Perez, which a lot of people are familiar with. I mean, that's one of the reasons I want to talk about this example, because that's a very familiar proof of contextuality to a lot of people.
But the other one,
it's essentially a proof that was given by Perez and Mermin. It's the same type of proof. Essentially, it says that there's a set of projectors to which you can't assign any set of values consistently.
Are there questions?